Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We'll take a moment now to remember legendary pianist Van Cliburn, who died this morning in his Fort Worth home after a long battle with bone cancer. He was 78. Cliburn soared to world fame in 1958 at the height of the Cold War when he won the first Tchaikovsky International Music Competition. And he returned to a ticker tape parade in New York City, the only musician to ever receive one. KERA's Bill Zeebel has this look back.
A tall, slim Harvey Levan Cliburn Jr. was 23, just a few years out of New York's famed Juilliard Music School, when the first Tchaikovsky competition beckoned. Here was a chance to further his career and visit a far-off place the Texan had dreamt of since he was five.
When I saw this photograph of the Church of St. Basil, it was just breathtaking. And I said, Mommy, Daddy, take me there. Oh, surely, son, yes.
That's Van Cliburn, recorded in his Fort Worth home in 2008.
And, of course, I had heard all the famous stories about the Moscow Conservatory. That's just a legendary place, and St. Petersburg Conservatory, because both are just so important in the world. And to play on that stage where so many great, famous people had performed was just breathtaking.
In April of 1958, Cliburn became one of those famed musicians. His performance of Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto was a stunner.
Played like an immortal. He played like a legend. He seemed to show them more of who they were than their own players were demonstrating.
Stuart Isikoff is a music journalist, pianist, and composer. He says the tension of the times helped seal Cliburn's status as an icon.
In some ways, there was a perfect cultural storm taking place at that event, because it was the middle of the Cold War. The Russians had launched Sputnik. People like me were diving under desks at school in case the Russians dropped the atomic bomb on us.
Cliburn was dubbed the American Sputnik. That November, in the midst of an international concert tour, he came back to Fort Worth for a dinner honoring his music teacher mother. One of the speakers had a surprise.
Dr. Earl Allison, who founded the National Guild of Piano Playing, got up. He said, well, ladies and gentlemen, I have a check here for $10,000, and I wish for it to be the first prize of a competition, international piano competition. I want it to be named for my good friend, Rilda B. Cliburn's little boy, Van.
A foundation was established, and the first competition was held in 1962. But Cliburn shrugged off all the attention, saying he was just a musical servant. Richard Rudzinski says the pianist took the words seriously. Rudzinski oversaw the Cliburn competition for more than 20 years. He's now general director of the Tchaikovsky competition.
Serving is a very big word in his vocabulary. He refers to presidents of the United States who serve a term, a queen who will serve her people. And he feels that he is serving the purpose of being able to bring beautiful music as he sees it from his garden to an audience.
Cliburn's recording of the Tchaikovsky Concerto went platinum, the first million seller in classical music history.
He gets a sound out of the piano that sings like nobody I've ever heard.
John Giordano has been Cliburn's friend since 1973. For decades, he conducted the Fort Worth Symphony and has been involved in nearly every Cliburn competition.
Opera is his favorite medium. So he emulates the voice. He tries to emulate the voice and is cognizant of the way a singer would play a particular phrase, which ends up, whether people realize it or not, reaching into their hearts.
including the Heart of Russian pianist Olga Kern, who won the Clyburn competition in 2001. Her musician parents heard and loved Clyburn in 1958 and played his music at home.
And I grew up on it, you know, and absolutely loved it. I loved how he transformed that music to a different level. He opened for Russian musicians how this Russian music can sound, completely different, more melodic, more softer, more dramatic. It sounded so new and so fresh, and it was incredible.
The reverence among the Russian people persists. Last year, for the first time since his 1958 victory, Clyburn returned to the Tchaikovsky competition as an honorary judge. He was mobbed on the street. Yet Clyburn was not without critics. In the late 1970s, the pianist withdrew from the public stage. Some blamed burnout, others said he'd lost his touch. Pianist Veda Kaplinsky, who teaches at Juilliard and has served as a Clyburn competition judge, has a different answer.
And he's a perfectionist, which is the reason why he eventually left the concert scene, because he was never satisfied with what he could do. He always wanted to do more.
He did more behind the scenes. He endowed scholarships at various music schools and funded some of the Clyburn competition scholarships. But he may best be remembered for his 1958 victory in Moscow. 4 years ago, he recalled riding through New York City, surrounded by cheering fans.
And as I was waving to them, I was thinking, isn't this wonderful? Not for me. They're honoring classical music. I was only an instrument.
Those closest to him say that modesty was the real thing. Before arriving in Moscow last year, Clyburn asked friends, in all sincerity, do you really think they'll remember me? In a final unexpected public appearance in September, Clyburn briefly spoke before a concert featuring past Clyburn gold medalists. The event was also a celebration of the competition's 50th anniversary. As Van Clyburn walked out on stage, the audience spontaneously erupted in a lengthy standing ovation. He talked for more than 3 minutes. Here's a sample.
I'm so thrilled to be here tonight. I personally want to thank you all for all of your faithful support. Never forget, I love you all from the bottom of my heart forever.
Bill Zeeble, KERA News.
Tonight at 8, KERA 90.1 will air an hour-long radio documentary called Remembering Van Clyburn. And Friday night at 9, KERA Channel 13 will rebroadcast a TV documentary from last fall called The Clyburn, 50 Years of Gold, about Van Clyburn and the international piano competition that bears his name. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a bully and what makes a victim? And what can parents, teachers, and kids themselves do to mitigate the scars that sustained harassment and social isolation can leave behind? Bullying has made headlines in recent years as some young people have committed or attempted suicide as a way to relieve their suffering. And while the vast majority of victims do not try to hurt themselves, many need help learning to cope with the taunting and to make other friends, just as many bullies need to learn to understand the emotional damage caused by their cruelty. Emily Bazelon is senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Her new book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So anybody who ever went to school understands that, sadly, bullying is an age-old phenomenon. Why is it such a top-of-mind issue right now?
I think that the rise of the internet has really changed what it's like to grow up. And since parents like me obviously didn't grow up online, didn't grow up with cell phones in their pockets, it's particularly hard for us to figure out how to deal with this new technology with our own kids.
I was really struck by a fact that you quote in the book, which is that at least for tween girls, there is a relationship, according to research, there's a relationship between heavy social media use and sort of negative feelings about the quality of their friendships.
Yeah, wasn't that striking?
Yeah.
I thought that was so interesting. I mean, basically what we're seeing is that especially for girls, and girls, I should say, are using social media and texting more than boys. Girls actually send an average of 90 texts a day compared to 50 for boys. Kind of amazing. So for girls in particular who socialize more on social media, they're just not getting as much of a chance necessarily to learn empathy. Empathy is really something the research shows we figure out through face-to-face interactions. So if you're spending just tons of time and hours on social media, you're just not going to get the same chance to practice.
And there's no subtlety in those little emoticons or whatever people use to try to convey what their true meaning actually is.
I think that's right. And also, you can't see the effect of what you're writing on the target, on the person you're writing to. And so sometimes kids say very cruel things without really thinking it through. That's another, you know, point of teenagehood. Their brains aren't quite as developed when it comes to impulse control as adults. And then they've created this lasting record, which can be really devastating for the person who receives the post, especially because it often takes place in front of quite a large audience.
Yeah, and it may not be that the whole world has witnessed one's humiliation, but when every one of the, you know, 60 people you care about thinking about you has seen it, then it feels like the whole world.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
So is cyberbullying, or what's called cyberbullying, a brand new thing, or just an extension of the tools available to bully?
I think it makes the most sense to think of cyberbullying as this new planet the kids have to express their feelings on. So they are going back and forth between their real world and their virtual world, and they bring their baggage with them.
We should probably take a moment here to talk about definitions. What behaviors are accurately defined as bullying, and what gets lumped in that's actually something different?
Yes, I think this really is important. So bullying, when you define it properly, is physical or verbal abuse that is repeated over time and involves a power imbalance. So what we're really looking at is chronic cruelty that makes kids miserable, where you have one kid or a group of kids really lording over their additional power. And I think what happens a lot of the time is once you raise awareness of bullying, even though there are benefits to that, people start imagining that every conflict they don't like is bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not true. The kids actually have a really useful word for this. They talk about drama. And usually when they are talking about drama, they're talking about a fight or an argument, aggression that's going back and forth. And that is not bullying, and it doesn't have the same serious consequences.
What have we learned about what makes some kids sort of easy targets? I can remember back to elementary school, and there were two boys that were just absolutely wailed on by the other kids for no reason that I could ever see in particular.
Were they smaller or weaker than the other boys, maybe?
I guess so, and a little more childlike. This was, you know, starting even in first grade. They were a little more maybe socially immature.
Right, so that's typical, that victims of bullying, particularly if they're boys, are physically weaker. And boys or girls, they tend to be more submissive, and childlike is a good word for that.
Mm-hmm. And do we know anything? What do bullies have in common besides sort of a sadistic need to make other people miserable?
What's really interesting and important about bullies is there are different types of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. There are some kids who are pretty sadistic and manipulative. I think of them as mean girls because that's our prototype for this kind of bully, even though some of them are boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they really deliberately set out to gain power by making other kids squirm. But there are other kinds of bullies who are much less sophisticated. They're known as bully victims. And they're kids who do lash out. They sometimes act like bullies. But they also tend to be victims. And the reason they're having all these problems is they have really just trouble socially. So often they end up doing the dirty work for the more manipulative bullies.
So many parents worry that their kids might not be telling them if they're being bullied. But it turns out sometimes reporting the abuse to sort of the officials at school does, in fact, make things worse.
Yes, that is a dismaying finding that kids report, that they sometimes try to go for help and it doesn't work. And what that suggests, I think, is that there are some schools in which there really is more work to be done changing the culture of the school so that instead of being rewarded for being mean, you get rewarded for sticking up for someone or for coming to your own defense. And that, I think, is a cultural shift we're kind of right in the middle of, where there are some schools where there's really a lot of awareness and the kids understand what bullying is and they'll tell you they don't like it. But we still have other schools where there's a lot of combat and aggression floating around and not much effort to really address it.
Are teachers pretty aware of the kids that are being targeted, or does this really happen outside of their view?
So the teachers, I think, often are aware of what's happening in school, and the challenge for them can be responding in the right way. For example, one thing that's not a good idea with bullies is to bring kids together for peer mediation. If you treat kids as equals, that's fine if they're having an equal conflict, but if one kid has a lot more power, they're likely to say what you want in front of the adult, and then as soon as they get out of the room, turn on the kid who has come to the adult for help. And then the other problem schools have is all this additional meanness that's going on online and trying to figure out how much they really need to police that world, which is outside of school.
Emily Bazelon is with us. She's senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Her new book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. We'd love to hear from you this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Her new book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Emily, I know that you started reporting extensively on this subject surrounding the case of Phoebe Prince, who died in 2010. Can you give us just a quick outline of what happened there, and then what sort of changed in your understanding of the nuances of that case as you got deeper into it?
Well, when Phoebe Prince tragically died in January 2010, there was a lot of blaming of the kids in her school and a lot of rumors about what had happened. And then a couple of months later, the prosecutor in Northwest Massachusetts, where she was, charged six kids with very serious criminal charges that really blamed them for Phoebe's death. When I looked into the case, what I found was that according to the kids at the high school, and I talked to a lot of different kids, the narrative that these six kids were really the cause of Phoebe's decision to commit suicide, that just didn't seem right to them. They didn't actually see Phoebe as a girl who had been bullied. They saw her as a girl who'd been in conflicts with other kids at the school over a couple of boys who she was interested in. But to them, the idea that there had been this pack of terrorizing teenagers who had really gone after her in a relentless, long-term way seemed wrong.
And then the other concern you have is that even had it been the case that this group of students had something to do with her decision to take her own life, there's no sort of chance for healing or even in some ways there's no justice in prosecuting these kids.
Right. I mean, it is a big deal to lay the death of one teenager on other teenagers. And what was missing in the initial reporting of Phoebe's death was that she had a history of depression and of cutting and of attempting suicide. And so it is true that bullying can be a trigger for suicide. And on the day of her death, Phoebe was called names in school that clearly upset her based on her text messages that afternoon. So it's not that there was no connection. It's that there was this very simplistic black and white narrative that got told, and that turned out to be very misleading.
I have not very much sympathy for people who bully other people, and yet in these cases, when you're talking about children committing these offenses, it seems pretty clear to me that the bullies also need help. Can you talk about what you've learned by talking to the experts on this?
Well, you know, you're right. I think a lot of us have this initial wave of moral outrage over bullying. And sometimes that is justified. When you really see a kid going after another kid, the first thing you do is stop it rather than try to understand where they're coming from. But if you dig a little deeper, often kids are really capable of empathy. They're just in an environment, in a moment, where they're not letting themselves feel that way. They're kind of freezing out those feelings. And what I discovered was that that's often because they are being rewarded. They're becoming more popular by being mean. And so that's the larger dynamic that schools and families need to turn around.
It's really interesting because it sounds in some ways like, you know, negative political ads, which everyone says they hate. And yet study after study demonstrates that they actually work.
Right. You're right. That is a good analogy. You know, another kind of more hopeful analogy I've been drawing is to drunk driving rates. When I was a teenager, I hate to say this, but it was a little bit cool to do drunk driving. I don't think that teenagers or even people in their 20s feel that way. And the reason is that we had a big mass media campaign and a lot of effort by schools and parents to explain to kids why this is such destructive behavior. And now we can really see the rates going down. So that, I think, is what is starting to happen with bullying and what I hope will continue.
I appreciated your candor here in writing about having a hard time standing up for a friend of yours who was being bullied. And I can remember feeling the same way, that you feel terrible for someone else, but you're so afraid that everything will sort of turn back on you that you can't jump in there.
Right. I mean, I don't want to excuse my own cowardice in that moment because I still really think about it. But when I think about my own kids, it is hard to stand up to someone who's powerful and often bigger than you and yelling really loudly. For good reason, kids are afraid that they will be the next object of public humiliation. So one of the things I talk about are other strategies that kids can use to help victims. You know, you can have a small moment of empathy where you go up and ask someone if they're okay, or you send them a sympathetic text message. You don't have to necessarily be the big hero in the moment to have an impact.
Yeah, so just the acknowledgement that you saw what happened and you care about the person can matter.
Exactly, and I think we need to give kids realistic strategies for getting involved rather than urging them to do something that's really hard even for adults to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to LB in Dallas. Hi, LB.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, boy, my heart goes out to you for the challenge that you're facing, but you're right about, as far as the long run, education, what it did for drunk driving, what it's done for smoking, over a long period of time, this could be helped tremendously by what you're doing. But in the short run, my personal feeling is that bullies are cowards, and there are ways. I mean, if one boy is bullying another, and it's constant and it's pervasive, I just think that if he gets the crap beat out of him and is told, "Don't ever do this again," he's a coward. He won't do it again. And I really believe in the short term that can work in some instances.
What about that, Emily?
You know, I totally understand the appeal of this idea, and if you think about movies about bullying, they end with this really satisfying punch where the bully ends up decked on the floor and we all cheer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, look, I think that can be a really satisfying end to the story. The problem is that a lot of victims are smaller and weaker and more timid. That's why they're getting picked on. And so to expect those kids to take this big step and, you know, knock out a bully, again, it's just not realistic all the time, most of the time.
And we should say, for people who sort of look at this and say, well, kids will be kids, there are, with sustained bullying, there are some long-term consequences for people's emotional health.
Right. I'm so glad you pointed that out. There's actually a brand new study from Duke that found that kids who are bullied, and also kids who are both bullies and victims, have strikingly higher rates of depression and suicidal thinking and anxiety 20 years later. So that's why it's so important to properly define this problem in a way that we can then really try to conquer it, because it does have these serious consequences.
We have an email here from Diane in Highland Village who wants to know, has your research addressed whether childhood bullies become adult bullies, or does it depend upon the type of bullies children are?
There is a connection between being a childhood bully and being an adult bully. There's a connection with domestic violence, for example, and actually a higher crime rate. So that is another reason that we should be concerned about this phenomenon.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Chris in Fort Worth. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Love your show. I just wanted to ask your guest, my sister was bullied when she was in middle school, and like me and my mom, you know, neither of us had ever experienced bullying while we were in school, and so I was dismissive of it, especially since my high school, you know, there was no bullying. My school was really good about cracking down and saying something happened, and so it wasn't a problem, but my sister was bullied, and we just kind of like, oh, you're not being bullied. That doesn't happen anymore. And turns out she was, and when we finally came to accept the problem and everything, we were able to resolve it, and she and this bully are now best friends. But I was wondering, what can you do for when you see people who are bullied and nobody believes that they're being bullied?
Thanks for your call. Were you able to hear the question, Emily? The connection was a little bad.
Yes, okay. I heard it. I think it's so important to really gather facts when you're trying to figure out what's happened. And you have to think of yourself as like a lawyer or an investigator. It sounds kind of silly, but one thing I've really discovered is that reporting about bullying is like reporting on a crime. There are different points of view, and you have to really sort out what happened. And once you have the evidence, once you're sure and you can really present the full picture, that's when it's much easier to show other people what's going on. This is one way in which social media can actually be useful, because adults can print things out or take screenshots rather than just deleting them.
So, Emily, you profile in the book some kids who were on different ends of this and in different situations. What do parents need to consider when they think about intervening or not, simply giving their kids a pep talk at home or going down to the school or making a change in the school?
I think you start by listening really carefully to your kid and figuring out exactly what happened, what their perspective on it is. It's always your job to be your kid's advocate, but the best way to do that is to have as complete an understanding as you can of what actually went on. Was it really bullying? Were they victimized? Or is this a more mutual conflict? And then another question to ask is whether there are parents of the kids who are potentially the bullies who you could go to who might actually be able to help. Sometimes that's not true. Sometimes the parents of bullies are part of the problem. But other times you can find someone who's trustworthy and try to resolve the issue privately. But I think often parents end up going to school because they feel like there needs to be a third party, a more neutral, objective person who can help them deal with the problem.
Maybe it's my own bias. It's hard to imagine if I would be aware of it if I had a child who was a bully. Is that a common problem, that parents have no idea that their kids are doing these things?
I think that's sometimes true, but I also think it's true that sometimes the parents of bullies don't want to see what their kids are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live in a culture right now where parents are so invested in their children, it can be very hard for them to see their children's flaws.
We have an email here that says, my child was bullied by his third grade teacher. When I complained to the principal, they assured me they were going to take it into consideration, but nothing changed. What can parents do even if school districts won't take action? Thanks.
That's a really frustrating problem that I hear about pretty consistently, that parents complain and they make a case and a school dismisses them. You can go up the chain of command to the school district or even the school board and try to find someone sympathetic who will understand what your kid is going through. If you really can't figure it out, sometimes you have to find a new school. I mean, I hate to suggest that because it's a pretty extreme remedy, but sometimes that's necessary.
What have you learned, Emily, about, you know, it seems like almost every school now has a program. Maybe it's just like a one-day seminar where they talk to the kids about bullying. Some of them seem to work, and some of them are like feel-good exercises for the people who put them on.
You're right. Some of them really don't have much impact. And there are a couple of really important features here. One is that a one-shot assembly or one day of staff development, it doesn't work. bullying is not a magic bullet kind of problem. It's like something where you have to do long-term maintenance all the time. And I think some schools really hope that if they have one day, they won't have to keep kind of tending this garden that they've planted. But that just doesn't work. And then another important factor is that successful programs, there are different kinds of them, but they all involve the whole school. You can't just target the bullies or the victims or even the bystanders. You really have to get everyone involved, and that includes the adults at the school, too.
So we are living in a changing world, but it's still clear that a lot of LGBT kids get more than their fair share of abuse from their schoolmates. Are there ways specifically to kind of look out for these kids and make sure that they are not being targeted?
Yes, there are. One really important tool are gay-straight alliances. There are more and more of them in high schools and middle schools across the country. And from the point of view of protecting gay kids, who, you're right, are still more vulnerable, that is a really important development. They are a strong buffer for kids, and not just gay kids, kids who are exploring their sexuality in a variety of ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jameson in Dallas. Hi, Jameson.
Yes, hello, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I guess I'm questioning really the need for mobile devices for students. I understand, you know, bullying is not going to really go away, and we're all interested in minimizing it, but to me it seems that putting the mobile devices in the hands of a teenager really only magnifies the issue, and having a 17-year-old daughter at home, believe it or not, does not have a mobile phone and has limited access to the Internet. It certainly is not a complete resolution, but I believe that's part of the solution, that parents mitigate their children's access to these mobile devices that propagates the bullying.
What do you think, Emily?
I am all for delaying access to smartphones. My 13-year-old just got his first phone, and we actually decided to give him what we called a dumb phone.
My kids have dumb phones, too.
So he can access the Internet, and he doesn't have a camera, which I think is also important. No particular reason why he needs to be walking around with one. You know, I really understand the push to limit access to these devices. Another tool you can use is to make sure your child charges the phone downstairs, not in their bedroom, so that they get a break for them at night. You can be amazed. Kids can be texting back and forth, you know, at 1 in the morning. But I think to take the devices away entirely, that seems to me like it's just not a societal choice that we're prepared to make. So what I really advise is for parents to think through when their kids are ready to handle phones and then what kinds of devices they should have.
What kind of exposure can parents help give their kids to proper ways of using social media? In other words, you know, sort of culturally and socially appropriate behavior online.
Right. This is another really important thing. When your kid first joins Facebook or whatever social media site, that's the moment to make sure you are guiding them through this new mode of communication. You know, the same way I wouldn't just open my door at midnight and tell my 13-year-old to go outside and take a walk, I don't want him going into this whole new world by himself without having a good understanding of how you use this tool. It's not that I'm planning to monitor everything he writes forever, but in the beginning, I want to have his password, and I want to see what he's doing so I can help him figure this out. You know, one of the things kids often do online is kind of experiment with a slightly different persona. My son texts in this voice that's really different from his speaking voice. But I don't want that to go so far that he turns into this kind of brash, mean kid online.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mohammed on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mohammed.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question was, like, it's in general that how much, bullying is a problem, and how much do we as parents and as teachers, I think, as my take is on it, is we have got a very large part in making those bullies. The social environment we give to the kids, the way we treat them at home, we are so busy making our dollars that we actually deny the love they should be having from us as parents and as teachers, and it's a whole nine yards. The thing is, the bullying is a problem, but what is the real solution to that? I don't think so. Only the child is a part of the solution, but as parents and as a society, we should be Liable, we should be a part of the solution.
Mohammed, thank you so much for your call. We'll get a response from Emily Bazelon in just a couple of minutes. She's senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. She's also got a new book out called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emily Bazelon. She's senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Her new book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You'll remember before the break, Emily, that Mohammed called to ask about how parents can be part of the solution. And if I could take the liberty of expanding on his question, I'm curious about how families can help children build resilience to this sort of thing.
That's such a good question. You know, one of the most important things we can teach kids is that most of the time when they have trouble, they can get beyond it. They're going to feel terrible for some amount of time, but that is going to pass. And we do that by bolstering their feelings of self-worth. So when you have a kid who's being bullied, you need to keep telling that kid how much you love them and really make sure to keep him talking to you so you know what's going on.
We have an email here from Mary in Dallas who wants to know what advice you have for when one sibling bullies another. My experience with this was with a twin, and it happened in and out of school.
This is really tricky. It's very hard for schools to intervene when you have kids within a family going after each other, and I think this is really up to parents to control. One of the things that I wanted to say also to our earlier caller is that parents are hugely important for building up empathy in their kids, and that's really something you can talk about around the dinner table. It's as simple as the idea of just giving kids a chance, prompting them to think about what it's like to be in someone else's shoes.
Do bullies need professional help to quit?
Some of them do. Some of them absolutely benefit from counseling, and they suffer from depression or things like oppositional defiance disorder, and it's really helpful for them to go to someone who can help them work through those problems.
Let's go back to the phone now. This time we have David on the line in Plano. Hello, David.
Hi, good afternoon. Great show as always. Thinking from personal experiences, because this is kind of true, close to my heart, and also thinking about the long-lasting emotional effects. I'd kind of like to hear your guest comment about the story that came out a year and a half ago about a Republican presidential candidate who essentially, I don't know if bullied is the right word, but essentially hazed a child, one of his classmates, and how they couldn't follow up on the story because that person ended up having psychological problems and I believe committed suicide. Or may have drank themselves to that. I don't know what the full backstory is on that, but I wonder if your guests could comment on that and also on bullies' remorse and how adults handle that aspect of bullying as they get older and either come to grips with it or just flat out ignore it, which is what it sounded like Mitt Romney kind of did.
Emily?
Right. I think that was the disturbing part for me of that story about Mitt Romney. So just to recap it a little bit, he was at this private school growing up, and there was a boy who was seen as effeminate. And Romney at one point cornered him and with a couple of other kids cut off kind of long hair he had and then left him there crying. And you're right, it did seem like this was a kid who grew up and maybe for other reasons too and had other problems. So what I found really distressing was that when the story broke, Mitt Romney claimed he had absolutely no memory of this other kid, knew nothing about it. And that just seemed like it couldn't be true. Or if it was true, it was also disturbing because it suggested that he didn't even remember this moment of cruelty on his own part.
Yeah, I was really interested to read in the book that there's research that says you get that bullies are going to remember for the rest of their lives, or bully victims, rather, are going to remember. But bystanders and the bullies themselves tend to have lasting memories of these encounters.
Absolutely. I've never felt before so much that I'm writing about a topic that everybody can relate to. I really find that it calls up these deep memories for people. And often it's just about incident they witnessed. But I think we all know how scary it is to feel stripped of all power and really exposed in front of a group. And so even if you're just watching that happen to someone else, it really stays with you.
Let's go back to the phone now. This time we are speaking with Jose in Arlington. Hi, Jose.
Hello. I kind of wanted to mention, like you guys already kind of touched on it, but I wanted to make an analogy between society as a whole and schools as a microcosm of that. I remember reading a study or hearing about a study recently about licking rats and how mother rats that licked their babies, they actually changed the DNA of those babies, and those babies nurtured their babies. And when it doesn't happen, the reverse happens. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that nurturing our kids properly and socializing them would prevent bullying. The problem is that the idea of stepping up bullying, we have to get everyone to properly nurture and socialize their kids, which, as we know, is probably going to be impossible.
What do you think, Emily?
I think the goal can't be to stamp out all bullying, because then we can just throw up our hands and say we're never going to get there. The goal has to be to make bullying socially unacceptable so that we have a lot less of it, the way we do with drunk driving and smoking among teenagers.
We have an email here from Ryan who writes, as someone who was bullied through middle and high school for being gay, I remember one defense the bullies would fall on was that they were not the true bullies, but I was for, quote, throwing my personal life in their faces. They were simply defending themselves. Administrators almost always bought this excuse. What's the nature of this thinking in the bullies, and how can we prevent bullying based on that idea?
I think this is a particular problem for gay kids, and I really see them as being on the front lines. They're being sent a message by the national media, when you watch shows like Glee, for example, that it's great to come out, that there's a lot of support for that. The problem is that in some communities, that is just still not the case. And so kids who come out, there's nothing for them there. And then instead what you find is that the kids around them feel like they are provoking the abuse that follows. That happened to a boy in my book named Jacob. And that dynamic will only shift when we have a culture in which it's unremarkable and accepted to be gay.
What kind of assistance and sort of action did Jacob want from his school in particular?
Jacob wanted safety. I mean, he got pushed down the stairs. It was physical as well as verbal abuse. But he also just wanted, I think, the recognition that the fact that he was doing things like wearing pink nail polish and dyeing his hair was okay, that he could be a boy and do those things. And I think at his school, there was much more a notion that it was one thing to be gay and sort of quiet and conservative about it, and another thing to be a more kind of flamboyant kid the way Jacob was.
Like somehow their attitude was that he was asking for it?
Yeah, exactly. That it's one thing to be gay and another thing to do things, another thing to be not a typical boy, to be really pushing the boundaries of gender, which some kids do express their sexuality that way. And in fact, legally speaking, they have a right to do that.
I wonder, you know, in terms of if you break bullying down into physical violence and social harassment, schools, a lot of schools have zero tolerance policies for any kinds of physical violence, but no real policies to prevent their students from being mean to one another. And I wonder if zero tolerance for violence has actually made it easier, more common for people to just say hurtful things.
That's a really interesting idea, that it's true that the rates of school violence and fighting on school property are down, and maybe we've kind of driven kids to be crueler to each other socially by taking away fighting. I think generally zero tolerance programs prove to be misguided. You know, for example, what if you're a kid who's a victim who takes the advice of our previous caller and punches the bully in the nose? You could end up being the kid who's suspended.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Val on the line in McKinney. Hi, Val.
Hi. I have a question. Nice program, by the way. What do you do when the bully is your neighbor? Basically, the bullying is not happening in the school environment, and I've talked to the mother, and basically they seem very checked out. They don't want to deal with the problem. That's too much of handling. But so that's not happening there. I mean, what do you do? We basically are trying to teach our son, you know, that this is not a proper way to, you know, for friends or for other kids to behave towards each other. But what else can we do, you know, in order to help our son?
Any ideas, Emily?
Well, if it's your child who's being bullied, you could keep him away from the neighbor's child. You know, sometimes the best message for kids is that if someone's not being nice to you, then you don't want to try to be friends with them. But if your child is more of a bystander watching this other kid, then that's also a moment to start talking about how important it is to stand up for other people and to try to help them. One of the things I've really been thinking about a lot is how much we value achievement and happiness for our kids versus the collective good and kind of building moral character. And these are moments where we really have an opportunity to talk about morality in a different way with them.
So like being popular is not more important than being a good person.
Exactly. That sticking up for someone weaker could be the most valuable thing, like just as valuable or more than getting an A in math class.
Let's go back to the phone now. This time we have Daryl on the line in Dallas. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. Hi.
You know, Daryl, I'm so sorry. Your phone line cut out there. I think you wanted to talk about ways of dealing with bullies in school. Will you talk, Emily, about what children say helps them? Like the kids that you've talked to that have had to kind of cope with this and get on with their lives. I mean, they have to go through school. What are the things that some of the kids that you've spoken with have said have been useful?
Well, small moments of empathy are huge. Kids say that the best thing other kids can do for them is to just express some small amount of sympathy. It doesn't take a whole lot. And then another thing I think kids really want from their teachers and staff at their school is for teachers to carefully distinguish between ratting someone out, which is really telling on them to get in trouble, and telling an adult something private because you need help. That's a really crucial distinction, and it can save kids from being labeled as snitches when they come forward and ask for aid.
Did you find that there are, for whatever reason, schools that have a greater culture of bullying than other places, and how are they different from schools that maybe protect kids a little better?
You can really feel it when you walk in the door. I spent a lot of time in a school in Connecticut that was just a very combative place. The teachers were sniping at each other and at other kids. There was a lot of yelling going on, and you could just feel that this was not a calm and orderly place. And that's the kind of environment that really feeds kids' level of aggression and makes them feel like the way to be powerful is to be really mean. So the kids at the school had all these different words for what they were doing. They talked about gunning on people and flaming and cracking on them. And that was how you became popular.
Are kids still targeted for, like, having the wrong, you know, in my day it was not having designer jeans, you know, mm-hmm. Are the wrong shoes still the sort of thing that people would get made fun of for?
I think that can still happen, especially with girls, where there are certain brands, like North Face is a big deal, I'm told. And if you're wearing them, you're sort of showing that you're popular or you're trying to be popular. And if you're not trying at all, you may get left alone. But if you're sort of trying and not quite pulling it off, that can be cause for being mocked.
Oh, gosh, that's so complicated.
I know, it's true.
I'm curious about, I know that you have two kids, the kinds of talks that you've had with them about all this, and if there were things that you learned having done all this research from your children that you wouldn't have learned anywhere else.
Well, what I've learned from my children is that it's really hard for adults to understand exactly what's happening in childhood every day, but that you just have to keep asking. The other day I got home and one of my sons seemed pretty mopey, and for a while he just didn't want to talk about it, but I finally got him to tell me that it had been baseball practice that had bothered him, and then a few questions later, he said, well, you know, all the other boys knew each other from basketball and football, and I was standing there throwing, and I just felt really self-conscious. I don't think he used that word, mm-hmm. But it took a lot of probing to figure out that it was a social issue that had been bothering him, and then we could talk about whether those kids really meant to be mean, which he decided they probably didn't, or whether he just felt left out because it was his first day.
That's a challenge, too, sometimes in helping them understand where other people are. If they're still at that point as kids where they may have empathy, but they're not so great at imagining that someone else might have different motives than they appeared to have.
Right, exactly. And kids can understandably feel anxious and insecure, but then if you really talk it through with them, they can see that maybe there's less to be frightened of than they think. Or sometimes they really do have big problems that we need to take seriously and really be there for them.
Have you just been overwhelmed with the response to this book from adults?
You know, what's really struck me is how much people remember their own experiences, how scared people are for their own children, and how confused my generation of parents is about this new wave of technology.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose we're all still finding our way through it. Should we assume that maybe our kids who've grown up with this technology will know what to prescribe for their own children?
Maybe, although there may be something different coming down the pike. And I think the basic lesson here should actually be a hopeful one, which is that, you know, it takes effort to instill values like empathy and resilience in your kids, but it's something you work at in a small amount every day. And honestly, I mean, this is what being a parent is all about.
Emily Bazelon is senior editor at Slate and contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Her new book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, it's been a really good hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about what we have coming up, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.